From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. For a quarter century, two giants of American journalism, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, waged a titanic struggle for supremacy in Detroit. It was a battle for readership, advertising, and for the control of powerful corporate interests. Ultimately, it was a battle for much else besides, as a conflict that began in Michigan made its way into the corridors of Washington and onto the front pages of America's leading newspapers. My guest today is Brian Gruley, author of Paper Losses, which is the story of this fierce and intricate conflict. Brian, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks, George. Delighted to be here.
Brian, Paper Losses, the book, for me as a reader, was many stories in one. I mean, there was sort of almost concentric circles of human drama. But at its heart, I would say, it has to be taken as an account of the epic rivalry between two great American papers, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. I'd love for you to give us a sense of that rivalry. First of all, why was that competition so intense, and what was at stake?
Well, like any of the great competitions of history, what was at stake was life itself, survival. And especially into the late 70s and the early 80s, it became clearer that in most towns in America, only one major daily newspaper would survive. And that was becoming very clear in the late 70s, and even more so in the early 80s, so that that was it. That's the best way to say it, George. Somebody was going
to
die.
Right, a fight to the death.
No question.
Tell us about the character of these two papers. I mean, are they, as organizations, aside from being intense competitors, are they distinctive in ways? I mean, how would you describe one paper versus the other?
Well, in the scope of the 25-year period in which I write, they were very distinctive. The Detroit News, owned by a family for over 100 years, since 1873, conservative in the way it operated its business, arch-conservative on the editorial page, one of the only papers to attack the New York Times for publicizing the Pentagon Papers in the early 1970s. A paper that prided itself on being a paper of record, and as a result was often somewhat dull, turgid, lots of copy, lots of reporters, lots of resources thrown at covering stories.
And always very authoritative, I guess.
Yes, in most cases. The Free Press prided itself on being nimble, unpredictable, colorful, irreverent at times, worked with a smaller staff, a smaller news hole, prided itself on not even looking at the snooze, as they called it, down the street, and had this sort of Avis mentality. We're number two, but we're going to try harder, and their grail was to pass the news. And they did briefly pass the news in daily circulation in the mid-70s, but they never could quite hang on up there.
Let me take us inside the Detroit News, which is clearly the dominant paper in Detroit at the time that this struggle breaks out, and focus our attention on the personality of Mr. Peter Clark, who's leading the news at this time. And Brian, it struck me that early on in this struggle between these two papers, irony becomes a factor in the conflict in this way. Mr. Clark, as I understood it, had a kind of a three-pronged strategy to not just advance the fortunes of his paper, but really beat out the Free Press. And it seemed to have, as I say, three major parts: to acquire additional media properties, the newspapers owning television stations, radio stations, as we know, is a very important part of what they do. Secondly, and here the emphasis seemed to lie, just to beat the Free Press in its circulation. This was a major goal of his, perhaps the major goal. And then finally, it struck me that he intended to take the Evening News Association, the parent organization, I guess, of the Detroit News, public, to offer it up for stock sale. But here's where I thought irony entered, Brian, and you talk us through this and tell me if I'm right or wrong, that at that point he almost unwittingly made his newspaper a target of a major takeover interest on the part of outside groups who just saw this as a desirable property.
That is the great irony and a tragic irony of Peter Clark. Peter was a very bright professor at Yale in the early 1960s, 1960, I should say, when he was asked to come to Detroit as the heir apparent, to take over the News as the publisher of the News, and take over the family company, which was founded by his great-grandfather in 1873. He was reluctant to do that for a lot of personal reasons and some professional. But once he committed himself to that, I think you're perceptive in seeing that his overriding goal, in any case, was to preserve the legacy of the News, which he had known as a boy growing up in Detroit. And to do that, I think Peter realized early on that he would have to stay ahead of his competitor down the street, the Detroit Free Press. But what ultimately did that family company, the Evening News Association, in was its conservatism. And it feeds right into what you were saying. One of the things Peter wanted to do and push very hard in the 60s was for diversify the company, primarily by buying broadcast properties, television properties, in what was called the Sun Belt. So as to be a hedge against Detroit's very cyclical economy, dependent very heavily on the auto industry. And to do that, he had to have money. Well, the people he was working with, the board of directors, all family members, all born and raised in the very conservative sort of business ethos of James Scripps, the founder, they only went about okaying this strategy very reluctantly. And one condition that always stuck was, we aren't going to borrow any money to do it. And as the 70s, late 70s and early 80s went on, essentially what was happening outside Detroit was spelling doom for this company.
That's an excellent point, and let's pick up on it. Mr. Clark's intent was to keep the News going as a newspaper.
Yes.
But it seems to me that it, at least a lot of the interest that was generated was to get hold of the News, control it, and then break it up, go after the broadcast properties, but really not a serious intent on publishing. There seemed to be a new universe of players entering this game.
Oh, yes. I mean, you had a lot of people who were essentially just investors. They weren't journalists or publishers or by any stretch of the imagination really interested in journalism one way, broadcast or print.
Right.
And ultimately, I mean, I think even then we could see that some of these people weren't going to be players. Mm-hmm. But what they did was usher in the players who had the wherewithal to take over the News, and they came in as white knights. And as it turned out, that company was the largest newspaper company in America, yeah. Gannett Company, Inc., the people who own USA Today.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about how Al Newhart and Gannett enter this and how they're perceived when they come in, because it's kind of interesting how they're immediately perceived by the news people.
Sure. First, I just want to say one thing that people always ask, how do you pronounce that? Is it Gannett or Gannett? And Newhart, an apocryphal story, supposedly said the emphasis is on the net, as in net income. When Newhart came in, he was, I think prior to that, if you had told somebody at the Detroit News that Al Newhart would be running the paper, you would have seen a bit of revulsion there as well, because
he had previously worked for the Free Press, had he not?
Well, he had worked for the Free Press in the early 60s when he was with Knight Newspapers and went on to a little company called Gannett that became a very big company called Gannett. That wasn't it so much. Journalists had problems with Newhart, wrongly, I think, in some cases, because of USA Today.
As kind of a new journalism, a new style?
Yes. I think people recoiled from his own personal style as well. A very flashy fellow, flamboyant, with limos and gaudy rings and jewelry and shoot-from-the-hip style. Actually, it was somewhat refreshing in a very staid and boring culture. It was sort of a Donald Trump for the newspaper industry. But the perception of Newharth and his company was that they put out a lot of papers that made a lot of money and didn't do journalism very well. But in the early to mid-80s, Gannett had made a couple of purchases of prestigious newspapers, most notable the Des Moines Register, that made people give Newharth maybe a second thought. So when he got to the News on August 29, 1985, he walked in the newsroom, tell everybody that Gannett had agreed to buy the Evening News Association, including the paper, and he told them what they wanted to hear. That he was there to beat up that little paper down the street, and that now the Evening News Association was owned by a company that had the resources, the wherewithal, to fight this battle to the utmost.
But wasn't the key point here, Brian, that the war had changed character without the people of the News really understanding that? I mean, in other words, for it's up to that point, the emphasis had clearly been on beating the free press and kind of the traditional news battle.
Yes.
And now you have a mover and a shaker and a player and everything else coming in.
We did not. I think the people at the News, we did not perceive how quickly Newharth would seek an armistice in the battle. And he did nothing to disabuse us of that notion. In fact, he encouraged us to believe that. It worked in his favor. In fact, as he was standing in the newsroom, getting us to clap and applaud. I wasn't applauding, I was covering the story, so I had to distance myself. But I was there, and there was a feeling of relief, and there was a feeling that, hey, this guy has the dollars. Now we have, we no longer will be bullied by the big corporation down the street. Now we have the dollars, the deep pockets, to go after them with everything. And even as he was doing that, George, he was already exploring the possibilities of an armistice in the form of a joint operating agreement with our rivals.
This brings us to the most dramatic chapters of the book, the armistice, as you called it, which depends upon a JOA, or joint operating agreement, between the two papers. This is after the Gannett takeover of the News. Tell us briefly, Brian, first of all, what a joint operating agreement is.
A joint operating agreement, I've explained this a million times to people in Michigan, and it's a difficult thing to get. A joint operating agreement is formed between two competing newspapers, and it enables them to merge all of their non-editorial operations, circulation, delivery, advertising, promotion, payroll, marketing, while keeping their editorial staffs separate. The people who gather the news, write the stories, take the photographs, build the graphics, write the headlines, so that you would have in Detroit a three-headed entity.
Yeah.
The Detroit News editorial staff, the Detroit Free Press editorial staff, totally distinct and separate. And a third entity that ended up being called the Detroit Newspaper Agency, which ran all of the business operations of these two newspapers. And the benefit to this, George, is twofold. First of all, it enables some cost-cutting, because you don't need two advertising salespeople for a certain area. Now you only need one, because they're selling advertising in both papers. So there were several hundred jobs that could be pared from the payroll and save a lot of money. But the greater benefit comes from a law that applies to JOAs called the Newspaper Preservation Act. And that law gives these two erstwhile competitors the legal right to fix prices.
Now I think it's time for us to introduce the other and principal antagonist of our story, Mr. Alva Chapman of the Detroit Free Press, which is owned by Knight Ridder. And this is also at this level. There's certain levels of conflict going on here. You have Gannett against Knight Ridder. The Evening News, Detroit News, rather, affecting an armistice at the end of a long fight with the Free Press, and the two pivotal characters of Mr. Newharth with the News, and now Mr. Alva Chapman with the Free Press, who, of course, has to agree to this joint operating agreement and accept in that the designation of his paper, the Free Press, as, quote, the failing paper of this partnership. Now, why is that deal attractive to him?
Well, Mr. Chapman is chairman of Knight Ritter. His number one responsibility is to his shareholders. And the Detroit Free Press had been losing money in increasing numbers, millions of dollars, since 1979. And Mr. Chapman had tried to negotiate a JOA with Peter Clark. But he failed to do it, largely because the people at Knight Ritter had woefully overestimated the magnitude of the news's losses. Hmm. The people at the Free Press thought they were whooping up on the news. They were mistaken. And with that bad information, Mr. Chapman was put at a rather serious disadvantage in negotiations with Mr. Clark, who kept holding out for much more than Mr. Chapman was willing to give. Can't say now, maybe he would have been willing to give more had he known that the news was not losing money in the magnitudes that the people at the Free Press thought.
I see.
So the Free Press comes to 1985, Gannett comes to town, and Mr. Chapman knows Mr. Newharth from many, many years before when they both worked at the Detroit Free Press, and figures Newharth has one albatross around his neck already. Hmm. He's got a paper called USA Today losing bushels of money. He doesn't need another one. So he's more than happy to go into negotiations over a JOA. The JOA, according to the accountants at Knight Ritter and the accountants at Gannett who are making projections, is going to generate anywhere from $50 to $150 million in profit a year within 5 years.
And it's going to be signed to cover a century, is it not?
It's going to be signed to cover 100 years.
You know, it's very important, I think, for us to bring out, as you do in the book, the fact that the progress toward getting a joint operating agreement did not proceed smoothly. It was clearly Mr. Newhart's and Mr. Chapman's intention that this be done without a hearing, without any kind of complication. But in fact, we do get a hearing, and this case gets even more complicated and actually ends up on the docket of the Supreme Court. This is a very complex set of proceedings, but in essence, what leads to those complications? What causes events not to proceed as smoothly as the businessman wanted?
Well, first of all, they didn't court their constituencies. They could have tried to seek the cooperation, in particular of their employees, of their readers, their advertisers. But essentially, the publisher said, we're going to apply for this JOA. We have a great case for it. We're going to get it. And that's the way it is. If you don't like it, that's the breaks. I didn't quite put it in those terms, but the effect was the same.
And that must have raised labor's hackles.
Oh, it's not hard to raise labor's hackles in Detroit. You had a long history of acrimonious relations between the 12 large unions at the Detroit papers and the publishers. As well, the lawyers and the publishers didn't understand or underestimated how difficult it would be to prove that the Free Press, the one they chose, was a failing newspaper. And in the end, ultimately, that's what stopped them, is that the unions were able to use internal memoranda from the News and the Gannett and the Knight Ritter and the Free Press to show that nobody thought the Free Press was a failing paper before they filed this JOA application. In fact, the opposite was true. They thought it was going to win the war. And they had adopted a strategy, which they called Operation Tiger at the Free Press, a strategy of spending great amounts of money and discounting ad and circulation rates so as to gain market share from the News and ultimately either put the News out of business or, and this is important, avail itself of the escape hatch of a JOA on its terms.
Right.
And an administrative law judge, looking at this evidence, finally concluded that the JOA should not be a reward for this kind of strategy, which few other businesses would pursue over a 10-year period mm-hmm. without this escape hatch.
Yeah.
So that is essentially where the opponent's case lie. And an administrative law judge recommended to the Attorney General that the JOA be denied on those grounds. The Attorney General, then Edwin Meese, disagreed.
Why does he decide that?
Well, I think, actually, I've read Meese's rather short opinion, an order that approved the JOA many, many times. And I'm no big fan of Ed Meese one way or the other, but I actually think in the end that Mr. Meese's opinion was probably valid. I have more problems with the law itself, and the law begged for this kind of travesty to be visited on itself. The problem with the opponent's argument was a rather naive assumption that, okay, let's set aside for the moment that these papers have engaged in these willful strategies. Well, they had this law there. It's a law. It's legal. So there's for them to pursue this strategy, knowing they could get a JOA, there's nothing wrong with that. That maybe the law was bad, but they were simply behaving like good business people ought to behave in some respects.
You've raised the very point I want to turn us to. Before I do that, though, let me just ask you this question, because this entire matter ends up on the docket of the Supreme Court, and they have a deadlocked 4-4 vote, which essentially ratifies the Attorney General's decision. It stands. That's kind of a profound and extraordinary thing for any issue in this country to end up on before the Supreme Court for decision. And here we have a deadlocked opinion on it. I mean, what's your reading of that, the significance of the Supreme Court taking this issue up and deciding it that way?
Well, it's very unfortunate because in a tie vote, there's no requirement for an opinion, and there was no opinion in the Detroit case. So, unfortunately, we don't know what any of the justices really thought, what they thought were the most important issues involved here. We know, and the book reports, who voted which way, because we found out later when Thurgood Marshall's papers were revealed. But without Justice Marshall's papers being revealed, we wouldn't even know what the vote was, because they don't disclose votes in tie votes.
I'm going to turn, with your help, Brian, to questions of analyses and your opinion on some of the issues raised in this. Before that, though, let me say that this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Brian Grewley. A former guest scholar of the Woodrow Wilson Center and a graduate of Notre Dame, Brian Grewley is Washington correspondent for the Detroit News, and he's the author of the recently published Paper Losses. You know, Brian, there are a lot of bottom-line questions and issues that are raised by this book. First of all, let me just ask you, kind of an impressionistic sense, are you bothered by the fact of seeing, or the spectacle, to use a word that we've used already, of big newspapers acting as big trusts in this way? And let me try to be a bit more precise with that question. The JOA is designed to take all this kind of process of putting out a newspaper and combine it and make it efficient and make it and allow two papers to continue doing what they're doing. The heart of a paper, I guess, for a reader is its editorial content, what it stands for. And when we think of the role newspapers have played in our society, it's very often been, throughout our history, as taking stands against not just unethical, but even shaky or questionable or slick or clever dealings and doings among the high and the mighty. And in that sense, at their best, and there have been examples when they weren't, but at their best, they've been kind of ombudsmen for all of us. And when you have the spectacle of major newspapers acting in this way, however legal it might be, is it bothersome?
There's no doubt about that, George. I should tell you, because it has a lot to do with why I wrote the book. I covered the story of the paper's pursuit of the JOA from August of 86 until the JOA went into place in November of 1989, and I wrote, 150, 200 byline stories about this. And I felt like I had, when I was done, I felt like I had assembled a great mass of facts that didn't really approximate a truth. And something bothered me about the whole thing. It bothered me that the chairman of the largest newspaper company in America would deceive his own employees openly, and his own readers and his own advertisers. It bothered me that both these companies would embrace the sort of duplicitous and hypocritical behavior that they deplored every day on their own editorial pages. And maybe people would call me naive or innocent for doing that. But on the one hand, it bothered me. On the other hand as well, I wanted to look at this strictly through the eyes of the person who would say, well, Mr. Gruley, you just, like a lot of reporters, you don't want to deal with paying the rent. Mr. Newarth loves to use that phrase. Now, never mind that at Gannett Company, paying the rent meant gold-plated bathroom fixtures and limousines and multi-million-dollar trips for the chairman around the world. Never, let's set all that aside. What I tried to do in the end at Paper Losses is hold these companies to the very crass business standards that business writers such as myself hold to General Motors and Ford Motor Companies of the world. And in the end, they were seeking a federal housing subsidy. They didn't want to pay the rent. And that law and JOAs, my conclusion was that they're not about saving papers. They're about saving franchises for companies that haven't earned them. And if we apply the market principles that they want me to apply when they say I ought to think about paying the rent, one of those papers should have been allowed to die, and the other paper would have been able to get about the business of investing in the future, which both those papers were barred from doing because they were insanely throwing away money at discount rates and giving away papers and giving awards to people who weren't deserving of
them. Yeah, I appreciate that very much, certainly on the personal level. And it leads me to this question, Brian. To conclude, I'd love to have your sense of how you feel about the profession of news gathering and news publishing in our country. Are you optimistic?
You called it news gathering, and I am optimistic about the future of news gathering. People want more information about more things today than ever before, and they can get it delivered to them in more ways and more quickly than ever before. Newspapers, I think, are going to be around for a long time. I think their form's going to change some, and I think they're already showing signs of seeking other ways to deliver the thing we do best, which is that, news gathering. Corporate ownership, family ownership, all those things, ultimately it comes down to giving people what they need and what they want. It doesn't matter who owns it. It doesn't matter who's running the paper, where it comes from, where the money's coming from. Its survival and its ability to thrive will depend on that, how it serves the people who get that information. And we just have to keep our eye on that ball.
And I think that's very sound advice, and I think it's an excellent book. The book is Paper Losses. And Brian Gruley, thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Brian Gruley, Washington correspondent of the Detroit News. I am George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
From APR, American Public Radio.